Do you want to support This Day in Miami History? Do you want cool swag? Well, visit thisdaymiamipod.com and check out our shop. You can find the link at the top of the page. There's a new item this month specifically related to the episode you're about to listen to on Interama. I hope you like it, and I hope you enjoy the episode.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
Imagine it. A giant development. Millions upon millions of dollars spent to create a place unlike anywhere else in the world. A place designed to bring the world together. A place where pavilions representing different countries can be visited from the convenience of Florida. All these pavilions around a body of water, the sparkling blue water, that is a signature of Florida we know so well. And at the center of this development, a white gleaming landmark piercing the blue Florida sky. Sounds nice, doesn't it? Also sounds like Epcot, the experimental prototype community of tomorrow, planned by Walt Disney and revealed in the 1960s. But what most don't know is, at least when it comes to the idea of this kind of development, Miami had Orlando beat by decades. Of course, for South Florida, it wasn't Epcot. It was the Inter-American Cultural and Trade Center, or Interama. It was an unbelievable idea, decades ahead of its time. So far ahead of its time, its projections were insane, and its completion was impossible. But despite its failure to get completed, its legacy still impacts Dade County. So that's what we're going to talk about today. This day in Miami history. January 30th, 1952. The day that President Harry S. Truman signed a joint resolution of Congress to endorse the construction of Interama.
The high times and low times, all in the nightlife.
While the president's signature doesn't come until 1952, momentum had been building for Interama for years. The first public declaration came on December 4th, 1949, when a committee of 22 local civic workers and businessmen shared a plan with the public to construct the Inter-American Cultural and Trade Center. Both the Miami Herald and the Miami News ran the full text of the report drafted by Chairman Dr. W.H. Walker. That report was shared with Governor Fuller Warren of the state of Florida that same day. It was a full court press of PR. But the spin didn't stop there. Walker, who was also the head of the Miami Chamber of Commerce, traveled to North Carolina the following month and met with the governor, W. Kerr Scott, promoting Interama and attempting to build support for the idea not just in Florida, but across the Southeast. Within 6 months of that, architects were hired, including Robert Law Weed, whose work is visible all across Miami-Dade County, as well as Russell and John Pancoast. Russell Pancoast and his father helped to draw the master plan for the city of Miami Beach, which was founded by his grandfather, John Collins. Rather remarkably, by September 1950, the United States Congress passes a joint resolution endorsing Interahamwe. In the resolution, the Congress endorses the idea of better relations with Latin America, alluding to the fact that, quote, during the past quarter century, outstanding statesmen, industrialists, and internationalists have frequently urged the establishment of such a trade center, and that the city of Miami is the most suitable location for such a trade center because it is the natural gateway of the United States to Latin America and possesses the additional advantages of moderate climate, ample hotel and recreational facilities, and long acquaintance with the people of Latin America. That joint resolution would lead, eventually, on January 30th, 1952, to President Truman signing the proclamation that started this episode today. It seemed like a charmed life for what would come to be known as Interahamwe. But the seeds of Interahamwe's undoing, which wouldn't be apparent for more than two decades, were actually planted only 2 months before the proclamation signed by President Truman. The planners of Interahamwe had two locations in mind. One, interestingly enough, was Virginia Key, right off the shore of what's now Brickell in downtown Miami. The second location is what was then known as the Graves Tract. Harvey Baker Graves purchased 1,800 acres of land from the Model Land Company, a subsidiary of the Flagler system, in 1919. That enormous chunk of land was eventually sold to the city of Miami, and it constituted, in the 1950s, perhaps the only large-scale open land giving off to Biscayne Bay without significant development. The city, which had acquired the land for almost $500,000 years before the Interahamwe plan, made the authority a deal. If they could commit to raising the money to build Interahamwe in 2 years, they would get the land for free. A rather remarkable deal. Hey, it's free real estate. But the authority couldn't raise the money in 2 years. The voice you're going to hear now is of the aforementioned Dr. W.H. Walker, explaining some of the struggles of Interahamwe.
Now, in 1952, we nearly had this money, the $40 million construction loan required. The abolition of RFC cut off all hope of obtaining it at that time from the government. In the following months, in fact, all the way through 1953, the bond market was in such condition that it did not seem proper or probable that we could enter the private bond market and obtain this money by private underwriting.
Those were some, but not the only problems that Interahamwe encountered. First off, you want to build a trade show with representatives from throughout Latin America. How do you get them to Miami? And more importantly, how do you get them to pay for the building of their pavilions? You've got dozens of countries, dozens of different currencies, and dozens of different economic conditions that each country is working with. Latin America was not necessarily a model of stability in the 1950s and 1960s, thanks in some part to the United States. Secondly, while the federal government passed joint resolutions and issued proclamations, there was no appropriation, there was no money coming from the federal government in the 1950s for Interahamwe. A lot of nice words, not a lot of dollars and cents. And so the funding had to come from somewhere. Finally, in November of 1958, the city abandoned the idea of transferring the land for a free or reduced price, and the Interahamwe board agreed to pay the assessed value of the land to the city. This was a turning point. A new wave of optimism was injected into the plan. Here is then City of Miami Commissioner and Interahamwe board member Otis Shiver.
I'm happy this morning to report the City Commission of Miami unanimously passed a resolution approving the plan which has been discussed recently about Interahamwe. I'm the most optimistic about this project that I have ever been, and I firmly believe that the Interahamwe project, which we have talked about for so many years, is finally going to get off the ground and become an accomplished fact.
So the Interahamwe Commission finally has land to develop on, but it's been nearly a decade since the initial plan was rolled out, and trying to build back the momentum that was captured in the early 1950s was a challenge. Thankfully for the Interahamwe board members, a significant change was underway in national politics, one that would put Latin America at the center of American political discourse, led by President John F. Kennedy. When Kennedy's foreign policy is discussed in Miami-Dade County, it's usually centered on a discussion of Cuba, and certainly Cuba was a big part of everything that Kennedy thought of when it came to foreign policy in Latin America. But the stick that was used against the Cuban regime after 1959 was not the only foreign policy tool used. There were carrots, and the carrots that the Kennedy administration distributed were through what came to be known as the Alliance for Progress, an effort to bring Latin American countries away from the influence of the Soviet Union and towards governance and economic stylings more favorable to the United States.
Therefore, I have called on all people of the hemisphere to join in a new Alliance for Progress, Alianza Para Progresa, a vast cooperative effort unparalleled in magnitude and nobility of purpose, to satisfy the basic needs of the American people for homes, work, and land, health, and schools, techo, trabajo, y tierra, salud y escuela.
That speech, given months into Kennedy's first term, and less than 1 month after the failed Bay of Pigs invasion in April of 1961, goes to show how important attempting to win back support in Latin America was to Kennedy. And what better way to do that than by a Pan-American conference hosted in Miami in perpetuity? Organizers felt the time was finally right. They were already on their third version of the development, and this one would ultimately be the most recognizable Interahamwe proposal. It was centered on the water of Biscayne Bay. The design could best be described as islands within an island, the larger island being Interahamwe itself, made up of four different constituent pieces, centered around the largest proposal for any building ever constructed in Miami to that point, the Tower of Freedom. Now make sure you don't get confused. This has nothing to do with what we now call the Miami Freedom Tower. In 1962, the Freedom Tower was simply the Miami News Tower. It was in that year that the federal government began processing Cuban refugees as they arrived in the United States. But the attempt at reviving the Interahamwe project is very much in the context of events on the island of Cuba after 1959. The 1,000-foot Tower of Freedom was designed by Japanese-American architect Minoru Yamasaki, who would later be best known for designing the World Trade Center in New York City. Despite the effort at rebranding and freshening up the Interahamwe proposal, there still were challenges, even with the federal officials who publicly were supporting the Interahamwe proposal. President Kennedy was pictured with members of the Interahamwe Agency on June 7, 1962, smiling next to the architectural renderings. But on a phone call with Miami News editor Bill Baggs, he was a little bit more candid about what he felt some of the weaknesses of the involvement of the federal government in Interahamwe were.
What sort of threw me off about the presentation was, number one, the great emphasis on the free enterprise, that this was going to be an ornament to the free enterprise system. I thought that was sort of rather nonsensical. If the federal government's going to have to put $50 million into it to prove that the government ought to stay out of everything. And the other thing was the amount of the federal participation. It would really add up to sort of a permanent fair, which would be constructive, but it was the question I had was really worth the dough. We were going to end up really building the Latin American and contributing the Latin American pavilions, and I didn't really think we were going to get much out of it. There'd be a lot of visitors pass by it, but I didn't know whether it would really make much difference.
Kennedy was being somewhat diplomatic with his friend, Bill Baggs, who was a supporter of Interahamwe. Some other members of the Kennedy administration were not nearly as welcoming of the idea of Interahamwe. In a 1972 oral history interview, Kermit Gordon, who served as a member of the Council of Economic Advisers and the budget chief, as well as Walter Heller, who was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers under Kennedy and Johnson, had less than kind words about the program, which by 1972 had foundered. Gordon called it some fraudulent operation. Heller simply referred to it as the Interama thing and the notorious Interama matter.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
The push for federal support continued, primarily through the state senators, Spencer Holland and George Smathers. 1962 saw an unexpected character enter into this lobbying effort. The man's name, Claude Pepper, a former United States senator that George Smathers actually beat to take his Senate seat in 1950. Pepper decided to run for the United States House, becoming one of the rarest creatures in American politics, a former United States senator that enters the House of Representatives for the first time. He had enormous name recognition and significance, and he also happened to be representing North Miami Beach, where Interama was going to be built. The assassination of Kennedy on November 22, 1963, presented an impediment, but the campaigning by Florida's federal legislators didn't stop. It escalated, this time focusing on President Lyndon Baines Johnson. Here's Senator Holland speaking with President Lyndon Johnson in 1964. You hear Holland doing his work, but it's quite clear that the most hardworking or annoying, depending on your perspective, legislator is Representative Pepper.
The second thing is on this Interama. Lord Pepper is pushing in every way that he can for him and me.
Yeah. Professor, I'm just, they murder me every day down here. I'll confer about it again, but there's not much more I can confer about, and we did when I went down there and spent an afternoon going over it. Our people think that we got to have an amendment to that housing bill, and then we don't know what we ought to do about it. And I can confer and confer, but I don't think that they'd tell me anything that I didn't know from what they told me that afternoon we spent on it. Claude has talked to me until I'm just almost blue in the face. And you know, that whole day in Florida, he's been a constant talk from the time we got in the helicopter till we got to Miami. I just don't feel right now that I'm at liberty to make a commitment on it. And I don't know it's embarrassing to me to just have to go through it again and sit there and be unable to say yes.
In part of the clip that I edited out because Senator Holland's voice was obstructed by the recording of President Johnson's machine, he alludes to the fact that local people need answers about Interama, and the local project needs federal support. Despite the pressure that Holland and Pepper and George Smathers put on presidents, plural, the fact that so much pressure is needed illustrates how weak the Interama project really was. The original idea was an exhibition that would largely rely on private financing after the initial land grant from the city of Miami. But by the time we get to the 1960s, everything appears to hinge on federal funding. It doesn't come through in 1964, but it does in 1966. Again, its support was not unanimous in the Johnson administration. William Bodler, who served as the State Department's Deputy Coordinator of Cuban Affairs in 1963 and 1964, and then served as the Executive Liaison Officer for Latin American Affairs with the White House from 64 through 68, wrote a memo to McGeorge Bundy, who was then serving as Johnson's National Security Advisor. In it, with his lens of Cuba firmly applied, he recommended support for Interama. believing that the $15 million in grant assistance and $22 million in loan assistance, then in H.R. 30, would present an opportunity for the federal government to assist Florida in integrating Cuban refugees into the state. Henry H. Wilson Jr., who served as administrative assistant to Presidents Kennedy and Johnson, interdicted the Bundy memo, and in response said that it's my impression that everyone in the administration regards the pavilion that the federal government was going to spend money to help build as purely a local boondoggle. A local boondoggle that in 1966 would finally get unified support from Congress and the president. But just as it appeared as though Interama finally, mercifully, had the wind at its back, it became quite obvious that there were larger structural problems in the organization of the plan. And in reality, it was quite simple. There was no funding mechanism to get the stuff done that Interama needed to pay for in order to qualify for the loans and federal funding, just like the land option with the city of Miami. Interama had to meet certain necessary requirements, and it just couldn't do it. It borrowed significantly just to clear the land of the Graves Tract. And that borrowing didn't build a single building on the land. By the late 1960s, there was an even larger problem related to those loans. Because, of course, this land had been transferred to the Interama Authority with the promise that Interama was going to build Interama. But the servicing of the debt became harder and harder with no revenue coming in. And it appeared as though this 1,700-acre chunk of land that Interama had claimed and basically squatted on for almost two decades now might wind up being repossessed, foreclosed on by the bank, and ultimately turned over to private developers for pennies on the dollar.
It appears quite definitely that unless something is done in a very quick and forceful manner, that we will possibly lose all of the property. I do not believe that the proper path is to sell the land, but I also feel that we have no alternative but to provide at this time the manager and the county attorney the wherewithal to proceed in this manner.
So why was the Interama Authority having such a tough time with this? The land that Interama was going to sit on alone was worth $64 million. Why couldn't it get the revenue through bond issuances to start building and actually bringing some dollars in? In my opinion, the answer is quite simple, and that is, from its beginnings, the forward-looking proposals of Interama were, for lack of a better word, bonkers. I look specifically at a document that was prepared by the Interama Authority that's just the fact sheet. And the fact sheet talks about all kinds of things and possibilities and each of the regions within Interama and the symbols of Interama, the key figures. But bullet point 5 talks about anticipated attendance. And I'm just going to read from that section. It's rather brief. Feasibility reports by Interama's management consultants, economic research associates, conservatively estimated that 12.5 million visitors will pass through Interama's gates each year. Attendance is expected to increase significantly as tourism to the state grows through the influence of Interama. 12.5 million is a big number, but to put it into context at how big it is and how bonkers the projections were. In the year that this document was printed, 1966, the state of Florida reported 17.5 million persons visiting the state in total. So the Interama Authority was claiming that it was going to bring in to Interama almost as many people as visited the entire state from Tampa to Jacksonville to the Keys to Miami. It was wildly speculative, and ultimately, the money didn't go because that speculation was way too far-reaching. Was it a boondoggle? That language is a bit strong. But there were clearly some fatal flaws in the plan. Lots of pretty drawings, lots of pretty architectural renderings, but significant functional problems in trying to make something like Interama work. What I also find so interesting about the Interama saga is how so committed so many parts of Miami-Dade County were to the idea of Interama clearly becoming real and becoming a success. The city of North Miami Beach changed its city seal to put an outline of the Tower of Freedom on it. The Golden Glades Interchange today was originally known as the Interama Interchange. So many parts of Dade County were built around Interama, knowing that it was just right around the corner. But ultimately, the county was left waiting for Interama forever. The Interama Authority had one more Hail Mary, and it wasn't with President Kennedy, and it wasn't with President Johnson. It was surprisingly with the Republican, Richard Nixon. Now, Nixon was a Republican, and Florida's congressional delegation at that point was significantly Democratic, including the aforementioned senators and Claude Pepper. But, as we've talked about before on this day, Nixon had a particular fondness for Miami-Dade County, especially Key Biscayne. So in 1970, Nixon issued a proclamation directing that Interama should be completed by 1976 so it could become part of the country's bicentennial celebration. But all the proclamations in the world weren't going to matter unless the dollars were there. And again, the federal government's contribution of dollars and cents really only went towards its own building once that came online. It wasn't enough to save it. Interama finally falls apart. The land eventually reverts to the city of Miami and Miami-Dade County, and the name Interama falls into obscurity. So what happened to the land? Well, the land winds up being incredibly productive, and it winds up being put to a purpose that Interama somewhat envisioned all along. The creation of an international university, Florida International University. The Biscayne Bay campus, which is there today and is thought of as the second campus, because the primary campus on 8th Street opened first, it was actually the original location that proponents of the university, the first public university in Dade County, that location on Biscayne Bay is where they wanted it. But Interama was hogging the land. Once Interama clears out of the way, FIU is able to occupy the space and develop its second campus, its Bayfront campus. The only building that was ever constructed on the site by the Interama Authority winds up becoming the home of the Chaplin School of Hospitality and Tourism Management on the Biscayne Bay campus. A small living legacy of what Interama might have been and winds up becoming today. As always, thank you for checking out this episode, and I do want to let you know something that I'm hoping to continue in 2025 is finding an opportunity to create something different based on the ideas of this episode. And the thing I'm creating for this episode is a t-shirt that features the design of the Tower of Freedom, an Interama t-shirt inspired by some of the architectural renderings that were generated in the third iteration of Interama in the early 1960s. I think it looks pretty good. If you want to find the shirt and support the show, you can visit thisdaymiamipod.com, click on shop, and you'll be able to see the design and some others that we've been able to make over the last few years. As always, I want to thank the Wolfson Archive, so much Wolfson Archive audio pulled for this episode, as well as the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library and the Lyndon B. Johnson Presidential Library. All those presidential phone calls were recorded there. Also, I want to shout out worldsfairphotos.com, which basically, it is exactly what it sounds like. It is a collection of information on the world's fairs of the world, as well as some of the world's fairs that never got launched, including Interama. A lot of original primary source documents are on that website, and it was incredibly useful in getting the ball rolling on the episode this month. Special collections at the University of Miami been known to use the library at UM from time to time. It was particularly handy with this episode. A lot of really rich images to draw from, the cover image on this episode, available through and modified after acquiring through special collections. So thanks so much to them for the work that they do. And as always, again, thanks to you, the listener. Remember to visit thisdaymiamipod.com to find our episode archive and our store, You can support the show there. And make sure you follow us on social media at This Day Miami Pod. Pretty much everywhere, you know, Blue Sky, Facebook, Instagram, wherever you're going to go, that's where you're going to find us. And until next time, I've been Matthew Bunch.
The high times and low times, all in the nightlife.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
GEICO makes it easy to get affordable renter's insurance in as little as 90 seconds. And then you'll start to wonder why everything else isn't so fast. Like, why does it take so long to do the dishes? A meal that's gone in three requires 45 minutes worth of dishes. Doesn't make sense. But it does make sense to get renter's insurance through GEICO. That way, that pile of dirty dishes and the other things you love are covered. Get more with GEICO.